today's special guest, Bob Hoy from Institutional Advisors.
Hey, Chris, good to hear from you.
And you as well. And let's talk about your new homepage at Institutional Advisors. It seems to be a lot of neat information and resources available.
Yeah, we update it from time to time. And the recent one, we did sort of the last little while here, and just I'm bringing it up myself here. I like the top part where we say, welcome to the rational fringe, and we've always felt that we've been rational because everything we do is based upon the original deep research into financial history. And I, first of all, when started working on that, I was reading some economists. And then I soon realized that, hey, that was the history of ideas. You really wanted was the history of the financial markets, which, well, original, you got, eventually were able to get price histories on bonds and interest rates going way back. And then you had got consumer price indexes going way back, and journals written by guys who were in the financial markets at the time, either in New York or going back further in London. And then all the history went together. So I guess my major contribution to the economic literature was to discover that when you would have periods, say 15, 20 years of dynamic economic growth, and of course we're talking about being in the senior economy in all cases. So you'd have a long period of dynamic economic growth that would finish off with a rampant burst of commodity speculation and soaring CPI inflation and wages going up and all that sort of stuff. And then that would reach a climax. That would set up a period of speculation in financial assets. So this is where actually I started going to financial institutions in 1981 and with an overhead slide projector and that sort of stuff. And now also to go back to 1979, 80, 81 is when the truth first started coming out about inflation. Prior to that, the establishment was going on that, oh, inflation was wage push or cost pull or something like that, and had nothing to do with reckless central banking. And Friedman came out and said that inflation is forever and ever always a financial thing with central banks. So the fund manager would then begin to shift over and realize that, hey, inflation seriousness is here to stay. And I came along and pointed out that no matter how much the Fed prints, financial assets would outperform commodity prices. Well, in 1981 and 82, this was highly controversial because they had all shifted their portfolios over to inflation forever. That meant getting out of bonds at 15% yield. The stock market had been terrible, so it was a rough time for fund managers. And then in mid-1982, of course, the markets turned around and exploded. And history is incorrect when they suggest that Paul Volcker personally ended inflation in 1981, because if you look at the Fed data, there was no the expansion of M2, for example, was relentless. And it didn't change. But what you did have was a crash in commodities like 1921. And what followed 1921? Well, a great big financial party. So that was the transition from inflation and tangible assets to inflation and financial assets. And the inflation and financial assets has continued with, of course, some bull and bear markets in between. But the regime of inflation in financial assets is still very much on. And it has now, the biggest bubble in history has been accomplished in the bond markets. The long-dated treasuries blew out in July last year, and it gave all kinds of technical signals. You know, it was upside exhaustions and sequential sell, and we had everything on that. Long treasuries have indeed come down in price quite a bit. And on that one in July, we noted that where the treasury market could correct, the low-grade market, junk bonds, could continue. And indeed, the junk bonds have continued to recent weeks, and we've got the same signals, upside exhaustions and sequential cell on junk bonds. So key thing on here is that the research I was doing called for a great bull market in bonds. The work we did last summer said that it's over. This is quite probable, and now that you've got having accomplished the same technicals, once you get that sector going down, then it'll get attention. And the reason for bond prices going down and interest rates going up would not be a big bulge of inflation coming along in tangible assets, you know, CPI and stuff like that. It would be due to an age-old problem of too much debt, not enough economy, and an inability to service the debt. So this would be the killer. We're looking for a great bond revulsion whereby everybody says, I'm not going to own bonds. And that seems hard to imagine now, but it could go on. But anyways, back to the revisions and the new home page on our website is that we put in some of the calls we made, like in 2000 when the great dot-com bubble was on, and using our work, we had to count on the yield curve and a few other things. And so in January that year, we counted out that probably the peak in speculation would be around March. And virtually every issue going out to March, we counted that out and then said, well, here, this is it. And then our technical stuff was showing, well, just how incredibly dynamic it was. And March turned out to be actually the high for the whole of that bubble, and then the collapse. And then we use our bottoming stuff, which then we had the model that calls for the tops of speculation are called upside exhaustions. And that same model is designed to give important bottoms, and we call that a downside capitulation. And the importance of having the bottoming technical side is that there's often a tendency for people to think, oh, stocks are really cheap, they're really down, and I'll buy some, and trying to catch a falling knife, which can be painful. So the downside capitulation is intended to or defer or prevent trying to catch falling knives and trying to get the bottom, and it's been reliable. And then the other big call, which we're very pleased with, was in 2007. On that party, which, of course, every speculation as it peaks, the telltale will be changes in the credit markets, either right at or somewhat before. So in that one, again, our count of 16 to 18 months on an inverted curve counted out to May. So we were looking for the yield curve to reverse at around May of 2007, and it did. And then we also expected that then credit spreads would begin to widen at about or soon after, and it did. And when it was about June the 8th, 2007, I was at a financial thing in London, and one of the slides was, on the PowerPoint, was an image of a very severe train wreck. And the comment was that the greatest train wreck in the history of credit was about to start. And indeed, it did turn out to be, because even the establishment later on did say that that was the worst calamity since the 1930s. So those are a couple of examples of calls. And then we've had some unsolicited remarks come in, and I'm rather pleased with them. Did a piece on central planning and big governments, that it was kaput. And a portfolio manager writes in, your treatise is simply outstanding. It's kind of nice. Then Bob Moriarty at 321 Gold pointed out that Institutional Advisors is one of the finest and most accurate subscription services on the web. Jim Grant at Grant's Interest Rate Advisor says, I thank you for this fine work on the bond market. So, yeah, it's a good record. I sort of enjoy looking back on it. And, of course, Chris, you always know that each one of these major turns in the financial markets, either at a top or at a bottom, is very, very difficult to make the call against the tide. And this is where one can do it, and many traders do it intuitively, but we like to do it with a lot of research backing up. And so this is where the historical has been a good guide. And then also my colleague, Ross Clark, with his technical work, which has been outstanding. And everything on the technical side is tested, to back tested and forward tested and everything else, until we ended up with the two tools that work. One is our upside exhaustions for the tops, and the other is the, what we call the sequential sells, which is patterned. I should emphasize that the upside exhaustions and downside capitulations, they relate to momentum and time, and then the sequentials, they are a certain pattern. So you've got momentum on one indicator and pattern on the other. And that's the basics of our business. Been providing research. I call it dealing in the foreseeable future since 1981.
Kudos for those comments. Of course, Bob Moriarty, just the best and top money managers. Like to go off on a bit of a tangent, off topic here today. One of our favorite shows here, Humans, is a UK or British science fiction, or some folks will call it fantasy. I call this sci-fi. In fact, I'd call this sci-fact, about AI and robots, where they are indistinguishable from typical human beings. There's a new season. They're calling it, I think, Humans 2.0. There's been some remarkable developments in artificial intelligence. Isaac Asimov, and of course, my favorite, Arthur C. Clarke, Philip K. Dick, the creator of every fascinating science fiction that's really made it in the last 20, 30 years, from obviously Blade Runner, Minority Report, Total Recall. Okay, completely unscripted. Alexa, weather.
Currently, in Sapphire, it's 53 degrees with cloudy skies. Today, you can expect showers, with a high of 58 degrees and a low of 45 degrees.
Thank you.
Sure, nice chatting with you.
You as well. Okay, so here's just a little idea, a $40 device my wife gave to my son over the holidays from Amazon. Plugs into your computer and into the internet, and once it's all set up, you can order items from Amazon. You can ask anything from the weather to the, I don't know, the atomic weight of uranium, of gold, of silver, anything you can think of on Wikipedia, every song that's almost ever been created, any music. If you'd like to listen to some Vivaldi, some Chopin, Tchaikovsky, Bach, Handel, Beethoven, Brahms, you name it, Mozart, instantaneously, it, my three-year-old already asking it to play his favorite Gummy Bears song. For decades, we've been hearing about how this would happen and there would be this AI revolution that would transform the world. But this is something that was just brought to my attention in the last few hours. IBM's DeepMind just defeated the world's Go Grandmaster. I don't know how many Go players we have and chess players, but I cut my teeth on chess. We have a big passion for chess and Go in my family. I learned Go a few years ago, and let me just say, it is infinitely more complex than chess. Well, they thought it would be at least 10 years before artificial intelligence. Nope, the Grandmaster was wiped off the board. What they did with DeepMind is they said, look, we're not going to build a model. Just as, you know, we're building models for our forecasts and prognostications all day long, multivariate models, regression models. No, they said, no, we're basically going to use a genetic algorithm, which is we're going to run a bunch of, you know, martingale hypothetical situations and let it, over 30 million games, start to improve on itself. In other words, we're not going to teach it. We're going to let it learn by trial and error. And I would argue most of the great accomplishments of this world, you might agree with this, Edison comes to mind. I bet that you'd find that Steve Jobs and Wozniak would probably agree with that. They're calling it a general purpose AI. It is applicable throughout the world. This is not just a Go AI. Anything we put it to, it just runs through the iterations. And by the time you wake up in the morning, it's Albert Einstein, Ramanujan. What we've had up until this point, Bob and our listeners, is we've had a pocket calculator. We all remember them. My gosh, they were $200. I'll never forget, I was about 9 years old when I first saw one in the store. It was just less than $200 at Eckerd's drugstore. The current AIs that everyone has, except for DeepMind, is a calculator. There's not a huge leap between a calculator and a computer, a general purpose computer. And we've seen what that's ushered in around the world. So there although they're identical almost mechanically. Well, I believe that's what we've just stumbled onto here. I believe we have not crossed the singularity that we refer to in artificial intelligence, but we are on the cusp. We are literally knocking at the door. We are about to cross the event horizon of the singularity, because I think that this is the most significant advance animal in intellectual evolution. We'd all love to have, you know, a team of the world's best traders working for us around the clock on the markets, right? Following maybe the euro dollar and perhaps the yen and whatnot, all these different markets, gold and silver, and trading on our behalf. Just the best minds in the world. I've run many hundreds of robots, won a few competitions, and I have a 3-year track record. Comes out to 89% win rate. If you had this deep mind general program working for you, it would run every bit of data on every time frame from tick by tick, minute, 5 minute, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, 60, on and on and up, you know, daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, all the different iterations of all the scenarios that have ever come to pass to outperform any single trader by comparison.
As for artificial intelligence, for decades I've been saying is that you have that at the Federal Reserve. You take an ordinary PhD in economics, put him as chairman of the Fed, and instantly they're a genius. One of the things that you got me going on with artificial intelligence is that, going way back, various people I know took the macroeconomic models, econometric modeling, and hired this is in the 70s, hired the Wharton Business School model. And these were two geophysicists running the computers at this big mining company, and they were trying to figure out the business cycle. So anyways, they got all the top model and ran the data through it for the 1920s. And it could not forecast the change you got in 1929. So then they said, oh, well, maybe we'll improve it with some geophysics models and stuff. We're doing some advanced mathematics. So they tried to improve the Wharton Business School's econometric model. They did a little, and they ran the numbers again. They still wouldn't get it. Now then, the reason why this econometric model cannot get dynamic changes ahead of time is because if you take a price series such as, the S&P, or commodities, it's anything that goes into a speculative surge. The final part of that surge is a skewed growth curve. And back in the day then, I think we looked around and couldn't find a proof that you could not solve skewed growth curves. But the conclusion was that you cannot solve skewed growth curves. And so this will be interesting to see if artificial intelligence can break that one. I'm doubtful. Then what you do then, by where this is where the history comes in, Chris, is that we look back. Oh, I remember the excitement of plotting down by hand. I'd been to the library, went through all the references on the South Sea Company, and wrote out the prices. And you could get them almost day to day, or certainly week to week, back in 1720. And you had this fabulous growth curve and skewed and went straight up and then crashed. Then plotting in the chart for Radio Corp of America, RCA, which was the really big deal in 1929. Hey, it's a similar chart. Then you move on further and you take a look at what was going on in the dot-com bubble that blew out in March 2000, put in, I don't know, Cisco, any one of those, and they're all the same. So you have a chart pattern that no mathematical equation can solve as it's going on, but then we called it the analog model because you just overlaid one on the other, and it was helpful in sort of calling it a top, and then later on, we threw in, Ross worked out his upside exhaustion programs. And then later on, from another researcher, excellent technician, we came up with and have been using his work on the sequential sell. So this is where I say that you have a terrific price history going way back to the 1700s. You use the history, and then For example, if we've got a target for a price series to rally up, like go back to crude oil in 2008 when it rallied up to 147. Well, you have a seasonal where you might get a high for crude around May, and then we then put on the upside exhaustion model on it, and that was in July, and we're getting a weekly upside exhaustion signal. So as I wrote it out, the weekly signal suggests that it would be a cyclical bear market would follow once the explosion was over. And then also noted that if the monthly comes in, then we would call for a secular bear market. Well, the monthly came in, and it went from $147 down to $35. That's how you can use the historical plus getting current dynamics with really top-flight technical research. As a matter of fact, one of the guys who a letter writer, I'll leave his name out. He's a good guy, good friend, and he said that Ross Clark is the Mozart of technicians. So it's recognized, by professional technicians in the street that my colleague here is doing some outstanding work, and I see his work, and we've worked together for a long time now, 30-plus years. It's been a good partnership, and we're enjoying it, and there's always work to do. There's always new techniques to try, and the whole business is let's make it work as far as research goes.
Extra kudos for that look back on your work. And, of course, anyone who has invested in the markets in any serious way knows that technical analysis is really the key. I mean, it has been for over 100 years since Livermore. I do want to wrap up the thought on the AI here before we move on, because I do have some important topicality that I'd like to bring up here with this thought. What if the powers that be, or some lone hacker somewhere, I mean, there are plenty of them now, there's a billion people have access to the internet at least. What if AI, okay, a sentient AI, or at least semi-cognizant AI, has already emerged? And nevertheless, it's wise enough, maybe like a cuttlefish or an octopus or something along these lines, or a giant squid, to recognize, well, I might be the biggest octopus or giant squid in this area, but, you know, I still have some threats, some risks. They could always turn the power off. I need to accumulate more information, more wealth, bitcoins, if you will, things of that nature. What I'd like to pose here today, there are some huge game-changing events that have just occurred. I believe that we'll look back on the cryptocurrencies, for example, and we will find a game-changing moment that very few people, even today, 5, 6, 7 years later, recognize, even authorities recognize as a game changer. And eventually it will enact its own form of Gresham's Law that will continue to push out all the fiat money in exchange for crypto, digital money. And I think that's going to be another component of this story. Just what will it mean for human beings to have ant-like intelligence, even the sharpest of our, you know, species, to be little more than an ant, an army ant, a soldier ant on the ground, compared to these super intelligences that are emerging? Eventually, they will start to accelerate their IQ at an exponential pace. We're already seeing that in technology. Here's a perfect example. The first billion years of this world of life involved the creation of DNA to form from a molecular structure into the DNA we now are based on today. It took about 100 million years for our current plant and animal life to emerge. Think of how much more quickly that occurred. It was a factor of tenfold. Thank you for indulging me, Bob, and listeners. John Ng, a very well-known money manager, some folks consider him really the tops in the field currently, in certain parts of the world at least. John Ng was just asked by the government of China to present his overview financially and economically with this new administration in place in the United States. He believes that what we're facing here is a near-perfect world for the metals. At some point, the new administration will go head-to-head, toe-to-toe with the Federal Reserve, which has been talking acting strong and hawkish on inflation, but in reality, it looks as though the dollar could be doomed because the new administration has so many big plans, big walls, big ideas in play that will require a massive amount of funding and ultimately could crush the U.S. dollar, sending gold at least to $2,200 an ounce.
The transition that's going on now politically in the U.S. is part of a global movement. We called it, July 4th, I published that piece called American Spring, and it is another great reformation. The last one happened in the early 1600s when, after 100-plus years of an experiment in authoritarian and at times murderous government, the public got fed up with it and found a way to throw it off. I've called it also the popular uprising. And the last popular uprising occurred in the late 1980s when a highly dissatisfied public in Eastern Europe took on murderous police states and shut them down. This then gets to the idea about the U.S. dollar going to go down. And one of the things that has been remarkable is the ability of the state to fund itself beyond confiscatory taxation. They've had the Federal Reserve, which has been corrupted, into providing unlimited funding for yet another experiment in unlimited government. And all of this is coming to an end. And this means an end to the chronic price inflation that's been on for 100-plus years. So I know John Ng well, but on the U.S. dollar, which is still the reserve currency, there's another factor beyond that. This is the end of a long experiment in authoritarian government and inflation on a post-bubble contraction. And the bubble that blew out in 2007 had a lot of the features of the 1929 bubble, and that was confirmed with the crash being the worst since the 1930s. And this, we're on the first business expansion and bull market out of a classic. But the main thing is in each post-bubble period, and there have been five previous ones, this is number six, that the senior currency has become chronically strong, as I like to say, against most other currencies and most commodities for most of the time. And the U.S. dollar index, well, I think the low was 73 in 2007 with the bubble top, now around 101. So that thesis is working out. And on a near-term chart, the correction we expected when it got up to 103.85 and came down to the 96 level, it's over, virtually over, and breaking above 102 on the DX would set the next uptrend. And our target then is up towards 110 or 112. You can mix in a whole lot of stuff, but there's a certain contingent out there who are gold-related, and they will look at anything and say that gold's going to go to 2,000 or 10,000 or whatever, and I don't think that type of analysis is going to work. It hasn't really to date. And what does work is the old historical. Now, here's where one can get excited about the gold stocks, because in every post-bubble contraction, the real price of gold has gone up. It's gone up significantly and makes the gold mining industry very profitable, so it becomes the best game in town. Now, I would sooner be bullish on gold stocks based upon rational historical evidence rather than some taking a look at a current event like Trump and his ambition and say, oh, gold's going to go to 2000.
We have to be a bit cautious with making some of these prognostications based on current economic events, because if we just go back to, let's say, 1982, we had only $900 billion in only. in our national debt. Fast forward to today, it's more than 20-fold that amount, and we were an economic powerhouse then. Now we're an economic powerhouse in decline. You know, there's a raging forest fire in all directions, and everyone has converged to the, you know, the mansion in the center. I think we are on the verge of something very unprecedented in the markets, and I think we'll see signs of that as the U.S. Stock market, the equities, roll over inevitably. Now, how long will that take? Do we have another 6, 12 months, maybe even longer? After a two-year consolidation, I'm sure you'd agree. What happens ultimately when that party's over, just as we've seen in the bond market?
As a matter of fact, we've got some technical excesses now in the senior stock indexes, and we're expecting a correction like right now. Until it comes in, and the nature of it, we can't tell whether the top, the big top, is in. But on the stock market, we're looking for a rounding top where not every index peaks at the same time. It can take a little while to roll over. But this, our last call for a rounded top was in 2015, and that worked out. It's very tempting to consider that perhaps this might be the top of the big bull market. But there's not enough evidence yet. And also, as I say, we're looking for the next leg up in the dollar index. This would put precious metals down. The targets we had for base metals on the base metal index, GYX, we reached those. We're looking for about 332 on the index for March, and it got to 339 already. Good enough. So we see that the lumber was hot until a couple of weeks ago, and that generated upside exhaustion signals. So the many commodities could be weak over the next few months as the dollar firms up. But this is one of the mysteries of post-bubble contractions, and as I like to phrase it, Chris, the senior currency becomes chronically strong against most other currencies and most commodities for most of the time. We'll stay with that one. And one of the mechanisms for the relentlessly strong senior currency has been that during the financial bubble, with all the debt that's issued, most of it has been written in the financial center, which is New York, due and payable in U.S. dollars in New York, and that then the biggest short position in history of U.S. dollars. And decades ago, generations ago, of course, it was sterling was the senior currency, and it was the same thing. And even if you go back to the mid-1500s, when Gresham was the financial agent of the British Crown in the financial center in Antwerp in Holland, and essentially his letters to the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Burleigh, were explaining that, hey, when you owe money into the financial center, you don't want to be paying it back from a weak domestic currency. It's the same old thing. So here you have, when the party was on, countries and corporations all around the world got cheap, cheap money. And they've borrowed more money than they can possibly service. And this is then what prompts the senior currency being strong. Now, it doesn't mean that the gold and the mining business is going to go out. All you have to have is that the cost of mining falls relative to the bullion price. And that's been the case in every post-bubble deflation, where the gold industry becomes very profitable and becomes the big game in town. So we are very bullish on the long term for the gold sector, but not because gold's going to go to $2,000, but because the real price of gold will continue up and it will enhance the profitability of mining gold.
What I'm watching and waiting for is the ultimate peak in equities, which I agree with you. I prefer to identify the peak after the fact. It'll sound odd to some folks. Yeah, look at 2007, 2008. We had a perfect, as you refer to, rounding top. That's how most market peaks are identified. Once that occurs, I mean, I don't think bonds will suddenly reestablish themselves as the go-to market. If equities lose favor, well, housing almost inevitably follows equities. There's almost a one-to-one correlation there. All of the go-to risk-on places and even pseudo-safe havens become less desirable. I think that represents at least a solid opportunity for the precious metals. Well, Bob Hoy, just great stuff today.
I always enjoy working with you, and you can find us at institutionaladvisors.com, or I've discovered even you just put in my name, B-O-B-H-O-Y-E, it comes up, and you get into our website, and there's some good stories in there. Okay, Chris, next time.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the 8th largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.